We do not turn on the news to become happy, but some days it's just hard to hear. The latest mass shooting is certainly a focus of attention at the moment. Then there's a recent announcement by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists that they've advanced the doomsday clock to 2 minutes to midnight because of threats of nuclear war, primarily between the United States and North Korea. Let's take a breath together, and then take up the argument in the book Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. In that book, authors Chris Katarna and Ian Golden make the case that we could be on the verge of a new renaissance. The book shows how the European Renaissance of 500 years ago was preceded by a period of turmoil. Ian Golden is a professor of globalization and development at the University of Oxford. Chris Katarna speaks and writes about globalization and the future, and his shorter works have appeared in Time and Vogue, among others. Chris Katarna is our guest for this hour. Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Jeff, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So you correctly predicted both Brexit and the Trump election?
You know, it's interesting. Sometimes you're right, and you don't make any friends for being right.
Right.
2016 was one of those years. And 2016 is when the hardback of Age of Discovery came out. Now we've revised it with a paperback that's just hit shelves. And, you know, if we think back to 2016, before Trump was elected president, before Brexit had happened, here in the UK, where I'm based, most people didn't give a lot of time to either of those possibilities. It just seemed like they were impossibilities in the world we lived in. And my co-author Ian and I, traipsing around with our message that, look, we live in a Renaissance moment, and a Renaissance is a time of tremendous shock and upheaval. And if we're going into this moment with very narrow expectations based on how things worked in the past about what is and isn't likely to happen, then prepare to be shocked, because, you know, our reading of the news is that something like Brexit is well within the range of possibilities for a moment like this. Something like the election of a populist outsider is well within the range of things that we should consider real possibilities, given the kind of upheaval we're living through. Then suddenly events conspired to, give our argument a lot more legitimacy, and here we are still making it.
So take us back. What got you and Ian Golden first thinking about the Renaissance as a parallel for now?
It's a great question, and it was a long road. I mean, honestly, the deep origins of this book were the global financial crisis back in 2007 and 2008. And Ian and I looked at that event and looked at a global elite who just did not see this shock coming. And we said to ourselves, something fundamentally is going on here in the world where there are forces and changes at work that are proving a lot of our expectations false. And if we want to get a better perspective on this moment we live in, you said a moment ago, let's all take a deep breath. If we want to take a deep breath and take a step back and gain some perspective on the now, well, how are we going to do that? It's very difficult to gain perspective on forces that are global, that are everywhere. I mean, you can't step out of it because it is all around us. And when we want to see depth in space, that's easier. You need two points of view, sort of a here and a there, and then our eyes can see depth. And so our basic argument is that if you want to see depth in time, depth in our present, then we need two points in time. We need a present and we need a past that is some good analogy to the present. And standing at that past allows us to see with just a wider view of history, of what is underway in society. What does it mean to live through a new medium of communication? What does it mean to live through the complete reorganization of our political and economic maps of the world? And what might the consequences of that be? And our argument is that that's what history is there for, right? That is the human story, is this free legacy of wisdom that helps us to get a handle on moments like now, where we just feel like it is difficult to put into perspective.
So when we think about the Renaissance, we do tend to think about the art, you know, the likes of Da Vinci and Michelangelo and Da Vinci's scientific achievements and Copernicus and the various people who realized the Earth is not the center of the universe. So all sorts of scientific advancements. We don't, I guess, think much about the bumps that led up to it, though. What were some of the horrible things that had happened to humanity, particularly in Europe, before the Renaissance?
Right. I mean, I guess maybe the most helpful way to think about it is if we flip back in the history books and look at the European Renaissance, so roughly 1450 to 1550, and what is the first line of their page in the history books? And it's the advent of print. You know, similarly for us, 500 years from now, people are going to look back on today, and the first line of our page in the history books is going to be the advent of the digital medium. Print had an enormous positive consequence for European civilization. It led to a flourishing of discovery. It led to an explosion of content, about 2,000 years worth of Western civilization, of recorded civilization, were copied in the first 50 years of print, and then copied again in the next 25. You had parents who had never seen a book have children for whom books were ordinary objects in their daily lives. And that led to an explosion of literacy and, of course, to the spread of ideas. It also led to religious revolution. It led to Martin Luther's Protestant Reformation. That led to a century of religious war in Europe because a lot of people struggled with the notion that the sun was the center of the universe, not the earth, or that the church might be fallible. And so really it was about energizing ideas. Some ideas lifted society up, and a lot of ideas tore society apart.
All right, much more to talk about with Chris Katarna in this book, The Age of Discovery, back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute five. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. And I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Of upheaval is born civilization anew. A rebirth, a renaissance is what happened in the middle of the 15th century and extended for 100 years beyond the Gutenberg printing press. All sorts of great things came out of a fairly troubled period in history when new things were happening. Well, that's sort of the time we live in now, is the argument that Ian Golden and Chris Katarna make in Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. It is now out in a softcover edition. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about whether all the troubles we're having right now are leading to something great. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email. It's jx@jeffnet.org. Chris, you did use the term, and Chris Katarna, I should point out, is our guest, and Ian Golden is not with us today. The concept of shock you mentioned earlier, that people were shocked by the fact that the global financial crisis happened. It caught the people who should have known how things were going to work by surprise. I mean, is shock always a feature of a renaissance, in your opinion?
It tends to be, and part of this has to do just with human nature. We navigate by maps. A lot of these maps are mental, and they tend to be backward-looking, which is fine when things are stable. But when we go through tremendous political, economic, technological, social upheaval, we can very easily get into situations where the maps we navigate by simply no longer describe the reality that we live in. And usually it's some shock event, whether it's the election of a political outsider or an economic crisis that was supposed to be impossible, that forces us to recognize, I do carry around these maps in my head, and I do need to probably take another look at the world today and understand, do they still work for me?
You say we get pushed around by crises and, in essence, get bullied by them. I mean, how should we more appropriately respond, in your opinion?
I mean, it's very interesting. When you go back 500 years, and look at the legacy of the thinkers of that time and how they were counseling people of how they navigate through it. One thing that Machiavelli talked about was his fear of fatalism. You know, he feared that, leaders would drift with rather than resist the tide of events and so be swept away from them. And his argument 500 years ago, and the argument we make again today in Age of Discovery, is that we need to take sometimes almost audacious, proactive stance in the moment we are in today, and see within the chaos of events that are dominating our headlines a compass that points the way. And that actually is a tremendously clarifying idea, that everything that is consuming us, the headlines, is actually pointing us at the real work that we need to do as a society today in order to make a positive flourishing come out of all of this change.
Has the flourishing begun, I guess would be the question. I mean, are we in the Renaissance that you and Ian Golden see for us now, or are we still in the upheaval that precedes the Renaissance?
You know, it may only be with the benefit of history of a few hundred years that we'll be able to answer that question. I think what is very clear is that the deep questioning is underway. You know, look, for example, today versus even just 10 years ago, the political questioning that we are doing, how it's a very pregnant idea in society today that, you know, we cannot take democracy, we cannot take our institutions, we cannot take public civility, we cannot take rationality, you know, all of these fundamental values upon which democracy is based, for granted anymore. Which arguably 10, 20 years ago we had started to do, right? The Cold War was over, communism had collapsed, we were the only game in town, and we could kind of take it for granted. Suddenly, we are now seized again with these questions. You know, similarly within our communities, whether it's the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement, the response that children have to gun violence, now in schools, there is a real, I think, effort to turn crises into moments of social change, of political change, of economic change. And so I think that the right ingredients are there and the right responses are coming. I guess the key point about this flourishing is that, you know, we often think that the big innovations that we need and that are going to come in this moment are technological. But actually, in a Renaissance moment, technology is just the tool. The big innovations are going to be social. 500 years ago, the Renaissance tore Western civilization out of the medieval age and ushered us into the early modern age. And you know, if we manage to harness this moment right, then we're going to do something similar, right? Our task in this age is to usher in the next one, to take us from an industrial age into maybe a digital knowledge age. And the challenges that we struggle with, that's the path to getting there.
Chris Catana is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He writes and speaks about globalization and the future. He and Ian Golden are the co-authors of Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. You'd mentioned a couple times now changing the maps in our heads, and there are plenty of those in the book. You make a convincing case for using those, and there's especially one that shows democratic countries now versus a few years ago. Which is rather striking, the number of places on the globe where there are ostensibly democratic societies. But the way it has been developing, though, I mean, does it seem like democracy also equals upheaval?
Well, that's going to be... I'm also a China scholar, so this is a question that is at the core of the debate in political scientists between sort of democratic and authoritarian forms of government. I mean, what we know and what I think we're all very seized with at the moment is, you know, we haven't simply opened up our societies. We have tangled them together. And to be open is also to be vulnerable. And, you know, perhaps we came as a democratic world a little late to to appreciating the duality of what we've been creating, through a process of globalization, of tangling together our politics, our economics, our trade, our finance, our media, and so this, I think, is going to be the big test for democracy in this second Renaissance moment. How do we maintain the respectful discourse upon which our democracy depends without it being kind of drowned out in some unaccountable lawlessness? How do we maintain the sovereignty of our own citizens in this globally open age where foreign interference seems so easy and also so difficult to detect? How do we improve inclusion in our societies for those who have been left behind by rapid change? So these are the questions that that we struggle with. I think, to put on an optimistic hat for a moment, what democracy continues to prove is that it is a terrific catalyst for social change and social inclusion. So if we look, for example, at just an enormous cultural shift in conversation that's happened across North America, here in Western Europe, about the role of women in society, I can tell you that conversation is not happening in the non-democratic countries of the world where there's far more control over this new digital medium. So yes, we are open, more vulnerable, but there are some very important cultural victories that we score for being so risky about our approach to organizing our societies.
Well, and the scattering of ideas comes through loud and clear. It was not necessarily that you were making the point that history does almost rhyme, but then you compare Gutenberg to Zuckerberg. I mean, the creator of the printing press with the creator of Facebook. Side by side, those do seem like two inventions that have really spread ideas farther and wider than they might have gone otherwise.
I mean, print is the big one, right? Because if you think about it, the advent of print, it meant that a continent of people who lived in a world where the only information you possessed had been handwritten by another person, and then suddenly in their lifetime that limitation vanished. And, what must that have been like? For most people in human history, it would be just impossible to relate. We're maybe the only other generation in the history of humanity on this earth that understands exactly what that must have been like. And so print is the big parallel, I think, between the first Renaissance and today. But it's not the only one. I mean, we live through a transformation from globalization, and Europe lived through a very similar one. The whole world did, thanks to the voyages of discovery, Columbus, Magellan, Da Gama, that connected and opened the world to a global trade for the very first time. The other big parallel, of course, that both then and now struggled with is that countries that had been on the margins of society in terms of global politics, security, economics, suddenly take center stage. Today, clearly that's China, it's India, it's the global south. And 500 years ago, of course, the new kid on the block was Europe, which until the Renaissance, every other civilization on Earth, literally drew them on the margins of the world maps. They were more or less irrelevant. And then suddenly, within 100 years, you couldn't achieve anything without thinking about the European question.
Chris Katarna, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a futurist, an expert on globalization, and a China scholar. He is the co-author with Ian Golden of Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. What do you think? Are we in a time in history when the upheaval actually leads to something wonderful and a rebirth of the human spirit? Join us on the Jefferson Exchange to share thoughts. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from Carter in Wolf Creek. Welcome to the Exchange.
Yes, good morning. May I be allowed to invoke the spirit of Blaise Pascal, who endured many troubles and did not live, I don't think, beyond 40 years. He said that taking the gender out of this, all of a person's troubles are from the inability to sit alone in the room quiet. And he meant quiet inside. And my point is that today most people do not keep a balance between mental activity and being mentally quiet inside, actually. And your guest is has brought up that he's a China scholar. I will say that in the Tao Te Ching, it is very blunt about when the people are aware of being quiet inside completely, which is then making it possible to be aware of the Tao, which is the silent source of all. Then things go well in the society. And when that is lost, there is great chaos in the society. And I believe that is what I just said is the basic dynamic of what's going on with us.
Mm-hmm.
And that is enough to say. And I'm aware that when I'm reading a book, and I sure do read a lot of them, that I am not being quiet inside, okay?
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks for that, Carter. Appreciate that. And you're right about Pascal. He lived 2 months past his 39th birthday. Your thoughts on what he just said, Chris?
You know, what's beautiful about Carter's remarks is it makes me think about a critically important aspect of the Renaissance and of this transition from the medieval to the early modern age, which was humanism, which was a philosophical movement around, you know, reintegrating and in a sense reclaiming from the Catholic Church, from religion, a power of the inner human spirit. And it really was, I think, one of the defining images of the first Renaissance was Leonardo da Vinci's Vitruvian Man. And I mean, I'm sure most of us have seen it. And what he meant by it, you know, there's sort of this man standing in a circle in a square.
He looks like he's doing jumping jacks.
Exactly. So he's doing his calisthenics. But the square with four corners, four seasons, represented the earth. And the perfect circle represented heaven. And by putting us in the center of both, Leonardo da Vinci was saying that, you know, unlike in the medieval past, where we felt that we were simply fixed in a human condition. Today, humanity, they were very, they weren't very politically correct with their gender distinctions 500 years ago. You know, he was saying humanity now is free to occupy both. You know, we can descend to the rude earth, we can ascend to the heaven, and fundamentally, it's up to us and whether we can do this kind of reintegration of ourselves to mine the spiritual dimension in humanity. So, I mean, that is, I think, very clearly an important aspect of the present moment that we live in, too. There's a, you know, this strong cultural reaction to the sense of atomization that we've created, to the sense of a kind of ahistorical self, that we just live in this increasingly finer moment. And now we're trying, you know, all of us in so many ways, whether it's mindfulness meditation, whether it's yoga, you know, whether it's travel or reading history books, to take that step back and rewiden our human experience.
Let's take another call. Here is David in Central Point. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Chris Katarna, the co-author of Age of Discovery.
Hey, guys, fascinating show. So he used an interesting word, which is duality, and there is a duality. There are two ways to look at this change to see if it's positive or negative. But definitely in Western thought, at least in my lifetime, we've strived to be more linear and more objective. And I think the danger in trying to be more objective is we lose reference points for evaluating whether these changes are good or bad. We're looking for objective reasons. Well, is it right or wrong? As we move away from dogmas, you know, we're asked, well, is it right or wrong to see these numbers change, like children born out of wedlock? And there may not be an objective reason why this is wrong, and so people are struggling to find their own metrics to evaluate this change, and so that's really fascinating to me, I think.
All right, good point to bring up. Yeah, that we're having to reconsider all the things that we once considered were X. They might now be X plus Y or something.
These two key words that David used, linear and objective, which are, I think, strong features of Western rational thought, and can lead to a tremendous productivity in moments of relative stability. The challenge is when we reach moments like today of massive upheaval, suddenly we see the cost and the consequences of having narrow, linear, objective ways of working through the world, and we need to rebroaden our creative selves in order to rewrite the maps.
Recalibrating ourselves, in essence.
Exactly.
Chris Kotarnik, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-author with Ian Golden of Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. Are we on the verge of a second renaissance? Join us by phone or email and let us know when we return from a break. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Chris Kotarnik, who is the co-author with Ian Golden of the book Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance, raising the possibility that this period in history, with all of its upheaval, is actually leading to something great and wonderful and a change in the human race. Many parallels the authors draw with the Renaissance of the 1450 to 1550 period, the European Renaissance. You can join Chris Kotarnik as we talk about the book, 800-838-3760 by phone. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So we've established that ideas moved freely in the European Renaissance. A lot more trade went on because of it. So goods moved, money moved with those goods. But people moved too. I mean, interesting to talk about migration then and now. Where were people going in the Renaissance, the original one?
There's a lot of parallels, actually, to present-day migration. I mean, of course, maybe the most obvious parallel is, as has happened throughout human history, people move where the opportunity is. And so in the Renaissance, when suddenly this new world, which we eventually called America, is discovered, and there are tremendous opportunities to explore new ocean trade routes from the west coast of Europe to Asia. And so you saw within Europe a massive movement of people from the Mediterranean to the Atlantic coast, and also from the countryside to the cities to take advantage of the economic boom that was underway. So, I mean, clearly we've seen a lot of that today. And again, as a China scholar, there's maybe nowhere in the world that kind of migration towards economic opportunity is clearer, but we're also seeing it within our own countries. People relocating when they have the means and the opportunity, when there aren't practical frictions in their household lives that make it not feasible. People relocating to other cities where sort of the new economy is taking place. And then, of course, we're also seeing quite a bit of more migration happening between countries. And then and now, that tends to happen as a country develops, as people have the means to escape the conditions that they're in and to sail to a new world.
To get to a better life.
To get to a better life or to pursue the dream of a better life.
So let's talk about distribution of wealth. This is really interesting when you get to this point in the book. I mean, for example, in the European Renaissance, was there much of a middle class as it dawned?
It was the beginning of the idea of a middle class in Western civilization within Europe. It was the beginning of real economic and social mobility. And prior to the Renaissance, Europe was mainly a feudal society. And then what happened during the Renaissance, as economies developed, as new technologies like gunpowder came into Europe and suddenly required states, governments, to be much bigger, more professional, to collect more taxes because you needed to build gunpowder armies and you needed to build forts to defend against gunpowder armies. There was a tremendous amount of state building that went on in Europe at that time, in addition to all of these far-flung voyages of discovery. And all of that required a new professional class, accountants, bankers, tradespeople, and merchants and ambassadors to just help all that stuff happen. It led to an expansion of who had access to education, and by consequence, just led to more mobility, where really for the first time, someone who was born into a lower class could ascend to, you know, good roles in the government or in the private sector. Of course, globally today, and you know, globally today in the developing world, there's been an enormous expansion of a middle class.
Many people lifted out of poverty, billions, I think, isn't it?
Many people lifted out of poverty, but you know, in the same breath, and this is where the duality that we talked about earlier is so important. I mean, 10 years ago, we would often end the conversation there. We would do this injustice of ending the conversation there and saying, okay, and that's the story of the moment that we are in. But let's not forget in the Renaissance that, you know, at the same time that tremendous economic opportunity was being created along these new ocean trade routes, there was economic devastation along the old Silk Roads on all these overland routes that suddenly were no longer competitive. And we need to recognize that the reality of economic displacement in our own time, which now is very much front and center in the public conversation. We recognize that we've created winners and losers. We recognize that we've created concentrations of wealth, and we've also created the many left behind. We recognize that today to miss out on education has a greater penalty in terms of life chances than ever before in history, right? And so it's really important now that we are so much more alive to the costs and the risks that we have created along with this enormous flourishing of genius.
I should point out, it's not billions plural. It's 1.1 billion, according to the World Bank, between 1990 and 2013, 1.1 billion people out of poverty. But as we've talked about, the unequal distribution of wealth indicates that progress can be polarizing. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that it ends up politically polarizing when it's economically polarizing.
That's right. That's right. And I mean, again, I mean, 2 years ago, if we had simply been looking at the world from this point of view, I don't think that many of us would have been shocked by the kind of political developments that we've had in North America, in Europe, over the past 2 years, as we reach some point where those who feel that they have been left behind, they have been disadvantaged, recognize that they can grab political authority and smash the institutions that a complacent establishment has erected, which, you know, again, this is the 500th anniversary of Martin Luther's Protestant Reformation. And if you had asked Martin Luther, you know, if you had asked people on the streets 500 years ago whether some monk that nobody had heard of would launch a continental revolution that would smash the Catholic Church in half, which was the ultimate insider elite establishment authority, of course, people would have just laughed you off the street. And then the next year, it happened. So, you know, now today, of course, you know, we are now alive to and grappling with the reality that we have created, that we have strained the bonds that hold our societies together, and that we can't take these bonds for granted. We need to renew them with every new generation, and that involves economic work. It involves political work. And it also involves social work to really understand the roots of those bonds and also what is straining them.
We have not talked much about some of the genius of the European Renaissance, and I'm particularly struck by Copernicus and the way he looked at the night sky and looked at the available information about it and said, you know, this doesn't work.
Copernicus is an amazing story. You know, and also a good parallel to the present. I mean, he put into human hands powers that until then had always belonged to God. And for him, it was defining the nature of the universe, right? To say that, it's mathematics, not the Bible. It's present-day observation. It's not revelation that tells us how the universe is constructed. And from there, modern science was born. It's tremendous. You know, a couple of just interesting anecdotes about the Copernicus story. One is that he was very, very nervous about sharing his insights. In fact, his publisher put a publisher's preface, which was not a usual thing, at the beginning of his book, that said, "Don't worry if some of this content seems heretical to you. This is really just useful for astrology. But everybody knows that mathematics can't tell us anything about reality, you know, with a capital R." And of course, at that time, what was math? Math was just this weird symbolic thing that didn't describe the world. It was just useful for some applications in the world. And it actually took about 30 years after he had made his discovery before, and it was a strong-willed student of him who finally urged him. He's like, okay, you can publish it then. You can publish it, and then we'll see what happens. And, of course, the rest, as they say, is history.
There's a very cool parallel in here between Albrecht Dürer, a famous artist then, and microchips now. And what is that comparison?
Well, it's very interesting because, you know, we live, probably the most sophisticated object that our civilization creates today is integrated circuits, is microchips. But the basic technology of how microchips are made today, which is that they are etched onto silicon onto silicon. Was discovered about 500 years ago, and Albrecht Dürer was an artist, and what he would do is copper plate etchings. So he would take a piece of copper, and on that surface of copper, you would put a layer of varnish, and then you'd take basically a small knife, a stylus, and you would carve, you would do your drawing into the varnish. And of course, wherever you carved, you removed a bit of that protective varnish layer. And then ultimately you put this plate of copper into a vat of acid, and whatever had been etched away, wherever the varnish had been etched away, that's where the copper would also be etched. And at the end of it, you're left with a copper plate that essentially has a drawing burned into it. That's the exact process by which we make microchips today. We have a piece of silicon, and you use ultraviolet light to burn onto the silicon the pattern of the transistors, and where you don't want it to burn, you put a protective layer on top of it. All we've really done is instead of a crude stylus, we've got these laser beams that allow us to have a very, very, very sharp point at the end of our knife. But the concept, we've just been refining it for 500 years.
I'm still struck by the comparisons, though, between the availability of books after the invention of the printing press and the availability of ideas in still written form via the Internet now. I mean, ideas good and bad can get around the world very quickly when they're in book form, and so much faster instantaneously when you have people connected via social media. I do like the fact, too, that you talk about tangling. Beyond just the point of connection, that we are sort of tangled together at this point in history. But the point being that I guess the good news that we can take is that so many ideas are out there now. We're thinking about a lot of things.
As a social scientist, there's something very powerful about ideas. And let me give you a bit of a wonky social scientific analysis.
Okay.
You know, if you take, let's say you had a graph of sort of per capita income and life expectancy, and you did that graph for every country in the world, and then let's say you drew that graph in 1950, and then you redrew that graph again today, what you would find is that today, for every level of income, people live longer. So the whole graph, the whole curve of life expectancy has just shifted upward over time. And the only reason is that we live in a richer environment of ideas today than we did 50 years ago. And you might say, oh, well, it's because we have new technology, we have vaccines. But things like vaccines are just ideas. Technology is just ideas that have been packaged into a tool so that we can all use it even if we don't understand the idea. And so as ideas, as the quantity of ideas in civilization increases, the statistics say we are all fundamentally better off. We all fundamentally live longer, which is, if you will, the most fundamental statistic that we have about living, because, you know, once you're dead, nothing else matters. So that's, you know, again, we live in this moment. I guess what I'm trying to say is, you know, we live in this moment where the aggregate picture, the big story, is so obviously good for us. I mean, we are healthier, wealthier, more educated as a species than ever in human history. And then so the challenge is, why do so many of us feel like we're on the losing end of it? And can we, as a society, figure out that distribution of gains and losses so that we can all live in this Renaissance moment?
Which brings us right back to the title of the book, Age of Discovery, Navigating the Storms of Our Second Renaissance. Ian Golden and Chris Katarna make the case that that is what we are entering, a second Renaissance. Chris Katarna has been our guest today. Thank you so much for joining us.